Thanks, David, for the introduction, and thanks for the invitation to present this talk today. So I think everybody who came to this lecture is interested to hear about a new form of matter, but I assume when you read through the abstract, you might have many questions. So it is matter made of matter waves, but you might ask, what are really matter waves? I'm talking about a new form of matter which forms at the lowest temperatures ever achieved, nano-Kelvin temperatures. But you might ask, why isn't it sufficient to cool to micro-Kelvin, which is a million times colder than the interstellar space? Why did we have to push to nano-Kelvin to see this new form of matter? I will talk about cooling techniques which enabled us to explore this nano-Kelvin temperature range, and one of those cooling techniques is laser cooling. I think many of you might ask, I think lasers heat. I can burn my fingers if I put my hand in a laser beam, but how come that lasers cool? And I will talk about atom lasers. And similar to the optical laser, lasers are based on amplification. So how can you amplify atoms? So I think there are a few interesting questions, and I hope to address them in my talk. But I also hope that I go beyond just explaining buzzwords to you. As David pointed out, it's an exciting, active field at the frontier of physics, and as an active researcher in the field, I want to convey to you the excitement of this new field, but also have an outlook into the future and discuss whether there are foreseeable applications or not. So, it's after dinner time, so I think I should try to serve a light meal, but I want to talk about the physics, and maybe the first thing I want to explain is, what are matter waves? Now, in classical physics, using our... I prefer that, actually. We use so many lasers in the lab, and so it's nice not to use a laser occasionally. I mean, if you're talking about particles in classical physics, you usually associate with them a position and a velocity. And many of you know that this is not a complete description. We have to use quantum mechanics, and in quantum mechanics, we associate wave-like properties with them. These are probability waves or wave functions, and the wavelength is given by the famous de Broglie relation, where h is Planck's quantum, and it's inversely proportional to the velocity. Now, those two aspects, classical particles and quantum mechanical waves, are reconciled by the particle-wave duality. Whenever we detect a particle, we detect a particle, but the particle propagates as a quantum mechanical wave. And it's the same duality which exists for light, for electromagnetic waves and the photon, so we have a similar duality for quantum mechanical waves and particles. But if the true nature of all particles is quantum mechanical wave, why don't we experience that in our everyday life? That is related to the way how wave propagation happens. And let me give you a few examples. Let's start with something simple, with sound propagation. If you are within a room and you talk to somebody outside the room, you can hear them, you can hear this person, although you're not in direct line of sight contact, because sound waves obviously propagate as waves, and you have a lot of experience every day with them. But the wavelength of sound is 1 meter. That's a very human dimension. If you now go to shorter wavelengths, let's say light, the typical wavelength is a micrometer or below, you can't see the person outside the room, simply because light propagates with a very short wavelength, and when the wavelength is short, then the wave-like properties are not pronounced, and we all know that light propagates in a straight line. Light is straight. So actually, from our everyday perspective, it is almost impossible to see the wave nature of light. Light almost behaves like particles which go straight. And it was actually only in 17th century that people figured out that light behaves as a wave. But what about matter waves? Quantum mechanical waves, their wavelength is even shorter. The typical scale is the atomic scale, 1 angstrom, or 10 to the minus 10 meter. So that's the reason why the wave nature of matter usually shows only up when we explain microscopic physics, the physics of atoms and the physics of molecules. But today I want to talk to you about new possibilities which have created giant meta waves which have a very long wavelength. And the reason for that is the following. I mentioned this fundamental relation that the wavelength of massive particles scales as 1 over their velocity. The famous de Broglie relation, which is one of the basic fundamentals of quantum mechanics. But now I hope you remember or you know that velocity is related to kinetic energy. And if you have a gas of particles, there's a one-to-one relation between energy, kinetic energy, and temperature. And as a result, the meta wavelengths of particles at a certain temperature becomes the longer, the lower the temperature is. Or to make this whole story short, if you want to have very long meta wavelengths, you have to cool a gas to extremely low temperatures. And this table shows you how the cooling goes. At room temperature, the meta wavelength of atoms is of the size of the atom. So impossible to see, and even for physicists, hard to notice. But if you cool to microkelvin, a million times colder than interstellar space, the wavelength of atoms is comparable to the wavelength of light. So we are getting into business. But I want to show you in my talk that by cooling even further, and the scale is now nanokelvin, we got even longer meta wavelengths, a 1/30 of a millimeter, and I will show you how we were able to directly photograph the pattern of meta waves. So how do meta waves affect the behavior of a gas when we cool it down? And that is the physics of Bose-Einstein condensation. At high temperature, you can imagine that the gas is like, it's like a bunch of billiard balls which zip through the container, occasionally collide, that guarantees thermal equilibrium, but we can use a completely classical picture. A box with a gas is like a box with tiny little billiard balls. But okay, I've just told you that the true nature of these particles is quantum mechanical, and we should associate with those particles quantum mechanical wave packets, illustrated by these little wiggles. But as long as the temperature is high, those wave packets, the size of them is given by this wavelength, by the meta wavelengths, those wave packets are very short. And actually, you can also get those, the size of those wave packets by just using Heisenberg's uncertainty relation. These atoms are smeared out over a region, which is just 1 over the momentum, and this is Heisenberg's uncertainty relation. So in any case, atoms are not point-like, they are wave packets, they are a little bit fuzzy, but as long as the fuzziness is much less than the spacing between atoms, we can still follow those, at least in principle, those fuzzy wave packets and observe their trajectories and use a classical concept. But now we cool down. The meta wave gets longer and longer, the wave packets spread out more and more, and when we reach the point where the waves of neighboring atoms overlap, then we have a fundamentally new situation, because these particles are now, even in principle, no longer distinguishable, and they form one quantum soup. Or in other words, when those particles, when the meta waves overlap, we suddenly reach the point where all these meta waves start to oscillate in concert. And this is the phase transition which was predicted by Bose-Einstein and is called Bose-Einstein condensation. So the criterion is that the meta waves are so long that they start overlapping, and then they form, the atoms form just one giant meta wave. And this giant meta wave is the lowest energy state possible, and the lowest energy state is the longest meta wave which fits into the container. I should point out that this behavior happens only for one of the two classes of particles which we know in nature. All the particles in the world, as far as we know, can be classified as bosons or as fermions. and the difference is simply made by counting the elementary particles inside. If you have an even number of elementary particles inside, for atoms that you count the protons, the neutrons and the electrons, if this number is even, you have a bosonic particle. If the number is odd, you have a fermionic particle. And I've just explained to you what happens for bosons. Bosons are sociable, are gregarious. They don't mind being in the same quantum state and forming this giant matter wave. But fermions are just the opposite. For them, we have the Pauli exclusion principle. They don't like each other and they want to stay away from each other. But it's a remarkable feature. Imagine you have an atom which has hundreds of protons, neutrons and electrons. And it happens to be a boson. And I just explained to you what happens in such a gas at very low temperature. It is this giant matter wave. It's the Bose condensate which forms. But now take one neutron out of the nucleus. We just make a different isotope of the same atom. It has the same chemistry. It has the same forces. It has almost the same mass. Nothing has really changed. The physical properties of this atom have not changed. But when you cool down a gas, you will see that the low temperature physics of this gas has completely changed because one isotope is bosonic, the other isotope is fermionic. So that just illustrates the mystery of quantum statistics. Now, David was alluding to it. Bose-Einstein condensation was predicted more than 70 years ago by Bose and by Einstein. Now you might ask, if that was predicted so long ago, why didn't people just go cool down a gas and observe it? Let me discuss that, but first let me remind you that the criterion for Bose-Einstein condensation, which I just explained, was that the matter waves overlap, that the de Broglie wavelength is comparable to the spacing between atoms. The de Broglie wavelength increases with the square root 1 over the square root of the temperature, and the spacing between atoms is related to the density of the gas. Or in other words, this criterion means that the critical density to observe this effect scales with the temperature in that simple way. Now, what does that mean for typical densities? If I would take water, or something at the density of water, and cool it down, this criterion would say cool down to 1 Kelvin. But of course, at this density we don't have a gas. I was talking about a phenomenon in a gas, and what happens is, at those densities, those gases form molecules, liquefy or solidify, so you cannot observe it. Actually, there's one exception. If you cool down helium, it liquefies, and at this density, at the density of water and temperatures of 2 Kelvin, it forms a superfluid. And superfluidity of liquid helium, a remarkable phenomenon, is related to Bose-Einstein condensation. But I want to talk about the much simpler physics of a gas. So let's just take a gas and cool it down, and maybe let's start with a gas like air or oxygen at normal atmospheric pressure. Then we would fulfill this criterion if we cool down to 10 millikelvin. But what happens if I cool down a gas down to 10 millikelvin? It doesn't stay a gas. It liquefies or forms a solid. So it seems, and that was the prediction for many, many decades, there is just no way to realize Bose-Einstein condensation in a gas, because before we reach this criterion, we don't have a gas any longer. The solution is maybe strange, but what we did is we took a sample which had the density of a gas, but a million times lower density. Then this criterion suggests that we have to cool down below a microkelvin, to the lowest temperatures possible. Now you would say, okay, if you cool down this dilute gas, it will still liquefy or solidify at those low temperatures, and that's correct. But what we are now exploiting is the following. A very low density gas, it needs a while to liquefy because several atoms have to come together, have to form molecules and clusters. So at those low densities, it takes about a minute for a gas to liquefy. So we can, for a minute, investigate such a dilute gas at such low temperatures. And that's where we find this new form of matter, and that's where we can determine all the properties. So let me just very quickly gloss over the experimental history of Bose-Einstein condensation. I mentioned the relation to superfluidity in liquid helium, but then decades of work, and especially recent work with spin-polarized hydrogen, were really made a lot of work to find the right gas, to find the right container where you could keep a gas for a minute and study its properties. And eventually, the major breakthrough came in 95 when three groups here in the US realized Bose-Einstein condensation, first the group in Boulder and then at Rice and MIT. So the major aspect of getting there, getting into this new form of matter, is cooling down the gas. So let me talk for a few minutes about the cooling techniques. And it's maybe not too surprising, if you want to cool from high temperatures to nanokelvin, you need a few different refrigeration schemes. There is not just one scheme which does all the job for you. And the first scheme which we are using is laser cooling. Now maybe some of you have recently read a lot about laser cooling because the Nobel Prize last year was awarded for work in laser cooling. Now, let me first explain to you how laser cooling works and then address the question, why do lasers normally heat? What is really the difference? Now, the principle of laser cooling is very simple. An atom can absorb a photon, and after a hundredth of a millionth of a second, the atom is re-emitting a photon. But now we can play some tricks. We can make sure that the emitted photon is a little bit more energetic than the absorbed photon. This difference is very small. It's one part in a million. But if we do many absorption emission cycles, we can get a lot of cooling out of it. And those small differences, there are several methods. That's why several people got the Nobel Prize last year. And one of those ways how we can change the energy between the absorbed and the emitted photon is simply the classical Doppler shift. But I don't want to go into details. This is the principle of laser cooling. Now, why do lasers usually heat? If you have a black T-shirt and you shine a laser on it, you will feel the heat. But the reason is that your T-shirt absorbs photons, but it doesn't emit photons. I mean, that's why your T-shirt is black. So laser cooling works only well for atoms, because atoms never make a mistake. Whenever they have absorbed a photon, with 100% certainty, they will spit out the photon again. And then we can get the cooling out of this tiny difference. But if an atom would make a mistake only once in a while, take the photon and transfer it into thermal motion, we could not do the cooling. So atoms are perfect, and that's why we can laser cool them. So the first stage of the cooling is that we take actually room temperature gas or even hotter, of in our case sodium atoms, and expose them to laser light. And with all the magic of laser cooling, which I don't want to explain further, we get a fairly dense and cold cloud of atoms in the microkelvin range. And when the pioneering work on laser cooling was done, people were very excited and they hoped to maybe see Bose condensation right away. But unfortunately, there were limitations. And I mentioned earlier that Bose condensation is not only about long matter waves, low temperature. You want the matter waves to overlap, so you need a reasonable density of the gas. And at those densities, the laser light just gets stuck, gets absorbed. So eventually, we had to switch off all the laser light, take this fairly cold sample, and use another cooling scheme. The first thing is we had to isolate it from the walls of the container. And this is done with a magnetic trap. This is just a magnetic field which do magnetic levitation of the atoms and make sure they are staying put. It's magnetic confinement. But then we have to cool the gas. And the cooling is done by actually a process which you are all familiar with. It's called evaporation. It's the same process which cools the water in a bathtub? Why does the water in a bathtub get colder? The hottest particles or the most energetic particles escape as steam, and the particles which are left behind, I mean, you feel they get colder and colder. Or the same mechanism cools a cup of coffee. And it works, so it works at normal temperatures and it works at nano-Kelvin temperatures. So what we do is, when particles collide, there's a certain probability that the outcome of a collision prepares one particle which has enough energy to leave the trap, and the particle which stays behind has very low energy. So the principle of evaporation is, let the hot particles go and keep the cold ones. The experimental setup to do that is shown here. It's a vacuum chamber. Just to give you the dimension, this is 4 inches, and you see fairly thick leads for current and for water cooling. They connect to the magnet coils which do the magnetic levitation. And then, very importantly, here's a mirror and here's a lens. And we use that to observe this new form of matter, the Bose condensate, which forms right in the center of this machine. But there's something else you should see. It's a machine which is a room temperature machine. We don't use any cryogenic media. We can really keep nano-Kelvin atoms in a room temperature machine and watch the atoms through windows. It is the combination of magnetic trapping, magnetic levitation, and ultra-high vacuum which provides fantastic insulation. So we can keep nano-Kelvin matter in the center of this machine. So, okay, now the question is, if we form this Bose condensate, how do we observe it? There are two ways which I want to explain now. Now, the first way to observe it exploits the fact that the Bose condensate is the sudden formation of a giant matter wave which has the lowest energy possible. It's really atoms accumulate in the lowest energy state. So you can observe that by doing an energy analysis. And energy analysis is done, you have particles in a trap or in a box, and then suddenly you switch off your trap. That's like removing the container, and then the particles just fly out. But if you have a fraction of your particles which have no energy, which are extremely cold, they almost stand still, they don't fly away. And that means, if we take a snapshot of an expanding cloud, and there is a big fraction of the particles which don't expand, that's the characteristic of Bose-Einstein condensation. And that's how it was observed. So what we take here is, we take snapshots of expanding atoms which were released from their container, released from the magnetic trap. And the technique is also very intuitive. We illuminate those atoms with laser light, and atoms absorb light, so they cast a shadow. So what I'm showing here is, I'm showing the shadow cast by atoms, and what is plotted is the blackness of the shadow versus the two spatial coordinates. So above the phase transition, we see sort of atoms spread out in the classical sense. But then when we reach the transition temperature, we see a spike in the middle. These are atoms which don't spread out. They almost stand still. And if we cool further, we have a pure Bose condensate or pure giant matter wave. Now I want to show you how this transition takes place by animating this sequence of data. So what you see now is what happens in our vacuum chamber in the last fraction of a second when we cool down. So you see these shadow pictures, and you see this shadow, that's the width of the shadow of the cloud, and the temperature is related to those numbers. I don't want to go into details here. So we're cooling down the last fraction of a second, and then suddenly the Bose condensate forms. It's a sudden process. It's a phase transition which happens at a very well-defined temperature. And eventually, if we keep it or if we cool further, we lose all the atoms. But the details of this formation has now been investigated, and it fits very nicely to the early predictions by Bose and Einstein. Okay, now, so this is both the Einstein condensation in a gas of sodium atoms, and let me just show you the result which was obtained a few months before ours. This is both the Einstein condensation in rubidium as observed by Eric Cornell and Carl Wieman in Boulder. Now, it's nice to observe Bose Einstein condensation in this way, but it has one disadvantage. You lose your sample because you expand your cloud and sort of just take a shadow picture of the expanding atoms. But there are many studies, and I will show you a few, where it is important to observe the condensate while it is still alive. So for that, we exploit the following fact that our magnetic trap is not like a box, it is more like a bowl. And now there is a one-to-one correspondence between size and energy. I mean, assume you have a bowl and you put in a few marbles. It costs energy for the marbles to climb up the wall against the gravitational field. So if you the lowest energy state of a marble is to be at the bottom of the bowl. So similarly, when the Bose condensate forms, it forms at the bottom of our, we call it trapping potential. Or in other words, the Bose condensate has the signature that all the atoms accumulate at the bottom of the potential. And we have observed that by using some special light scattering technique. We were scattering light and observing the scattered light with a camera, and that's what we observed. First of all, you see light scattering of the cloud before it condenses. Now that looks odd, it looks like a cigar, but it just tells you that our container is very elongated. It's easier to make an elongated container with magnetic fields than a round container, but that's just the shape of the container. But then when we cool down, we see at a very sudden value, we see this sudden accumulation of atoms in the middle, at the bottom of the container. I should say in many of these pictures we use colors, but it's rather color coding of an intensity. So red just means many atoms, yellow means fewer atoms, and blue means no atoms. It's just a convenient way. So let me just, before I go into more details, give you some motivation. Why is it interesting to explore that, and what are the interesting aspects? The first one, you can say you want to control atoms. If you can make atoms stand still, if you can control the quantum motion of atoms, then you can perform very precise measurements on them. And actually, for decades, people have tried to make atoms slower, confine them, just with the goal of doing very precise measurements. Why do we need precise measurements? Number one is we want to learn something about atoms, but we are also using atoms for the most accurate atomic clocks. So the global positioning system only works because we use atoms as our frequency standard and perform very precise measurements. So if we control atoms even better, cool them down to lower temperature, we expect improvements in that area. The second aspect is, and I will talk more about it, that we use the Bose condensate as a major step to realizing an atom laser, a source of coherent atoms, which might have applications in atom optics and atom lithography. But thirdly, and let me say a few words about that, the Bose condensation is a macroscopic quantum phenomenon. It's one of the very few phenomena which we know in physics where the microscopic physics of quantum mechanics shows up on a macroscopic scale. And usually those phenomena are called super. I mean superconductors and supercurrents, superfluidity. These are remarkable phenomena where fluid flows without viscosity, where currents flow without resistance, because the underlying principle is quantum mechanics. And here we have for the first time super gases, gases which show this remarkable quantum behavior. And this macroscopic quantum behavior is often expressed by saying that all the particles, all these millions of particles in the Bose condensate, are just one single wave function. So the pictures which I want to show you in the next half hour or so, you can regard them as photographs of wave functions. And wave functions are the solution of this Schrödinger equation, this basic equation for all of quantum mechanics. So if you think the wave function is something mysterious, now you can photograph it, you can see it. How do we see that those particles behave like waves? The first thing we saw was when we looked more carefully at the expansion of the cloud. I mean, let's just discuss what happens if you have thermal atoms, normal gas, in a container, and you remove the container. They move out to all sides. Or more specifically, they move out isotropically, because the gas was in random motion. And that is independent what the shape of the container is. They are in random motion. They move as much left, right, up, down, or at any angle. So when we switched off the container and we had cooled below Bose-Einstein condensation, we saw the following spreading. At the early times, you cannot see so much. We start with a cigar-shaped object, but the cloud is absorbing most of the light, so we cannot easily see the structure. But now here you see there is a spherical component, and this is the normal gas, the gas of everyday life. But then you see there is a second component which is much denser, which is spreading out much more slowly, and this is the Bose condensate. And this very anisotropic spreading, this is the signature that it's a matter wave. Let me show you that in an animation. Okay. Red means the black as black shadow, so it's again a shadow picture, and now you see this isotropic circular pattern of the normal of the thermal gas. These are atoms in random motion. But then you see the second component, which spreads much more slowly. And it spreads in this anisotropic pattern. And this is the signature of the Bose condensate. And careful comparison with theory has shown that this motion is in full agreement with the wave equation. So this is a matter wave. But I will show you later much more striking signatures of matter waves. If you have a new form of matter, what are you doing with that? Sometimes I think physicists behave like children. If you give the child something new, the child is looking at it, it sort of squishes, it drops it, and that's exactly what we do. I've just shown you how we drop the condensate and watch the expansion. Now I want to show you what happens when we shake the condensate. So we have this condensate in this magnetic trap, which is like a marble in a bowl, and we just kick it, and not too surprisingly, it oscillates back and forth. I mean, it's classical motion in some sense, but the extension and all that, it is a wave function in motion. But that's sort of trivial, because a classical particle and a quantum particle do exactly the same thing. But we can do more subtle things. You can kick it in a way where it's not only moving up and down. If you look at this, it contracts, it stretches, it contracts, it stretches. So it does some shape oscillation. And that's fairly interesting, because when we analyze this oscillation, we can learn something about the internal forces of this object. Let me show you how this looks in real life. So we have a condensate, and we kick it and observe what it's doing. So now we sort of kick it, and now it starts stretching and shrinking. What you are seeing here is you see the time dependence of a quantum mechanical wave function. Theorists have very carefully calculated it and have found full agreement with the prediction of some Schrödinger equation. The motion happens at about 20 hertz. We have slowed it down by a factor of 10, so it's convenient to observe. And actually, I think you now see that there is only this sloshing motion, this stretching and shrinking became less vigorous. So actually what you have seen with your own eyes now is you have seen that over the time scale of 1 second, this motion, this oscillation of the condensate are damped, they damp out. And we took many of those data. We studied how does the condensate oscillate at various temperatures, and sometimes it's more damped and sometimes it's less damped. There are actually many theorists who are now performing calculations, and the detailed understanding of these results is leading to new formulations of many body physics. So those experiments and the understanding of them are progress in understanding how matter works at low temperature. Now, let me change gears and talk about the realization of an atom laser. Now, there is no rigorous definition what an atom laser is, but there are many analogies to laser light. So I want to show you that we were able to realize, in very close analogy to laser light, intense coherent atomic beams. And the generation of them was done analogous to the way how laser light is created, and that's why atom laser is a descriptive word for it. So in some sense, you can regard an atom laser as a device which does for atoms what the optical laser does for light, or you can regard an atom laser as an intense source of coherent matter waves. So it builds upon the close analogy between matter waves and electromagnetic waves. So what are the analogies? One of them is that if you want to build a laser, you need a cavity or you need two mirrors to bounce the light back and forth, and that's when eventually all this amplification happens. Now, what is a cavity for matter waves? Actually, that's our magnetic trap. If you have a condensate, which is a standing wave in such a trapping potential, this is analogous to atoms which bounce back and forth between magnets. It's like magnetic mirrors for atoms. So it's a fairly easy and trivial analogy. But the real subtlety is, how do we generate coherent matter waves? Now the quick answer is, we just do things analogous to the way how we generate coherent light. I assume some of you are familiar with the principle how laser light is generated. You start with a weak laser beam, pass it through an active medium, which has some excitation energy. Then atoms are de-excited, they emit a photon, and that joins in the laser light so that the laser light got amplified. That's the principle of light amplification, which is at the heart of the laser. Now we do the same thing with atoms. If we have a coherent matter wave and we pass it through a cloud of atoms, we can amplify the matter wave. So we can amplify atoms. But I think you immediately realize that this is not in conflict with creating atoms out of nothing. We have taken atoms out of this active medium and we have put them into the coherent matter wave. Or to say it in that way, the optical laser is not generating energy. It takes energy out of maybe a wall outlet and transforms this energy into coherent electromagnetic waves. The atom laser takes atoms out of a reservoir and transforms these atoms into coherent matter waves. So we haven't done it exactly in this way, but we think in the long run it should be possible that you take a coherent matter wave, or Bose condensate, you pass this condensate through an ultra-cold cloud of atoms, and what comes out is a larger condensate. So that is matter wave amplification. Now, Let me try to explain to you the physics of this amplification, because I think that's really mysterious. How does a matter wave amplify itself? How does a matter wave induce other atoms to join in? Let me first remind you that the basic principle of any amplification process is you amplify a current or any quantity n if the change of this quantity is proportional to the value of the quantity. That's what you call a linear amplifier. If you have more current, the rate of change is higher, and so you have even more current afterwards. That's the principle of amplification. Now, how can we amplify a matter wave? The situation is now really quantum mechanics comes into play. We have a matter wave, and we have atoms which collide. And now I want to talk to you about the possibility that one of these atoms joins the atoms in the coherent matter wave. And now, that's really a subtle point of quantum mechanics, but that atom can join. But it can join in the first place, in the second place, in the third place. There are n plus 1 possible places for this atom to join. And they are all the same, because all the atoms are indistinguishable. And that means in quantum mechanics that the process for this atom to join is n, or actually n plus 1 times enhanced. So it is really the indistinguishability of quantum mechanics, or if you want to, a symmetry property of nature, which creates this factor of n. And this is at the heart of matter wave amplification, or just to use other buzzwords, stimulated scattering or bosonic stimulation. In any case, let me just summarize. Because of quantum mechanics, we can amplify matter waves, and we try to observe it. And the way how we observed it is we just looked carefully at the way how the condensate grows. When we form a Bose condensate, and we observe that after we have finished the cooling, the condensate is first not forming at all, and then it starts. And by carefully looking at this process, we got evidence for this matter wave amplification process. And the reason is the following. I mean, this amplification process tells you if you have already many atoms in the matter wave, the amplification is stronger. It's like an avalanche. You start with a little snowball, and the larger it gets, the faster it builds up. And this is exactly the way how the condensate forms. So we saw exactly that when we started already with a snowball with the condensate, it immediately got amplified. But when we had nothing at the beginning, we first had to start with a small snowball, and then the big condensate was building up. So that is strong evidence for matter wave amplification. Now let me talk about a second aspect of the atom laser. An atom laser consists of coherent atoms. And what means coherence? I like this artist's picture, which depicts so well what we mean by coherence. It means that all the atoms march in lockstep. They have one phase. They behave as one wave. And actually, if you look carefully, the artist has also added a few guys which move crisscross. I mean, I was alluding to them earlier as the thermal atoms which were in chaotic motion. But this is the condensate, atoms marching in lockstep. Now the question is, if you want to show that we have realized an atom laser, we had to show that the atoms march in lockstep. How did we do that? Now, marching in lockstep means they have the same phase. But in quantum mechanics, it's a phase which cannot be directly observed. You can only observe the relative phase of two quantum objects. But that's also often how you observe the phase in classical experiment. It's hard to measure phase absolutely, but if you have two objects, you can observe the relative phase. And that's the physics of an interference experiment. Well, let me explain that again. If you want to observe the phase of the Bose condensate, the best way to do it, not just look at one condensate, look at two condensates, and try to see a wave-like interference pattern. Now, I don't want to go into details how we created two condensates. We just created a bowl with a divider wall in the middle that gives us two condensates, and the divider wall was a special laser beam. Okay, the idea was now very simple. If we have two condensates and they are pure matter waves, in the moment those matter waves would overlap, they would show a wave-like interference pattern. So what we did is we took the two condensates, switched off the trap, they were falling down, spreading out because of some repulsion and some zero-point motion, but then they overlapped. And we hope to see the interference pattern, the signature of a wave in this region. So what did we expect to see? Let me just remind you, what is interference between waves? Let's just assume for simplicity these are radio waves, and in the middle there is an antenna. That's your favorite radio station. Now we take a second radio station and move it at a certain distance, and you see an interference pattern. So this pattern is characteristic for waves. And as you notice, this pattern is curved. This is the characteristic shape. If you have monochromatic waves, their shape is a hyperbola. Some of you might have seen those experiments in high school. But that's not what we are really doing, because we have matter waves, and we suddenly switch off our container and let the waves spread out. And now the following happens. You remember at the beginning, I mentioned that the wavelength of matter waves is 1 over their velocity. That means if a pulse of atoms spreads out and we take a snapshot after a while, the atoms which are the furthest out, they were the fastest, and therefore the matter wave has to be shorter here, whereas the atoms which after a while only made it so far, they are slower, and that's why the matter wave is longer. So if you take now two such pulsed matter waves and interfere them, you get an interference pattern. But it consists of perfectly straight lines. So when we did the experiment, we were very pleased when we observed this interference pattern between both condensates. The technique how we observed this pattern was again this shadow technique. You see this interference, you illuminate it with light, and then you look at the shadow. This is the shadow of matter waves. And it's in that sense a dramatic effect, because here, for instance, there is no shadow. That means we had two atoms from two different Bose condensates, and we have the remarkable effect that an atom plus an atom gives no atom. That's destructive interference. Of course, we didn't destroy matter, it just appeared somewhere else in the pattern. So the total number of atoms is, of course, conserved. Okay, talking about the atom laser. I've talked about the amplification process, the matter wave amplification. I've talked about the coherence. Let me just also mention the way how did we generate a laser beam. And that was actually fairly simple. We confine our atoms in a magnetic trap. But we can now use radio frequency pulses to manipulate the atoms, or to be more specific, to transfer them to a state which has no magnetic properties. And the atoms are only held by the magnetic trap because they are themselves tiny little magnets. But some radio frequency pulse can switch off the magnetism of the atom, and then the atoms just fall out because they are no longer magnetic. And that's what we observed. Let me show you how the experiment looked like. Okay, at the top you see the trapped Bose condensate in the magnetic trap. And every 5 milliseconds we use an RF pulse and we make some of the atoms non-magnetic. And then they are accelerated downward by gravity. The field of view is 2 by 5 millimeter. So we pulse out atoms every 5 milliseconds. So what you see is a pulsed atom laser with a repetition rate of 200 Hertz. And this crescent shape of the atom can be fully explained by the wave equation for those atoms. That was again observed by the shadow technique. We illuminated from the side and looked at the shadow which was cast by these atoms. So what I've done here is I've simply programmed in a loop function, so it goes around and goes around, but that's probably a couple of years in the lab, namely to upgrade our pulsed atom laser to a continuous atom laser. What we had to do is now is every 10 seconds we had extracted all the atoms from our Bose condensate, and then we have to reload, which takes about 20 or 30 seconds. Okay, the two more things I had prepared. I mean, since we have a research meeting here, where many of the best research of the world came together to discuss Bose-Einstein condensation, I thought I just want to give you, maybe a little bit faster, but in 5 minutes, a glimpse, what are recent accomplishments in the field. So what are students and researchers at universities doing? What are advances? And one of our advances has been that we are now able to confine, to trap Bose-Einstein condensates, not with magnetic fields, but with light. The reason is that, we'll talk a little bit more about applications, or we want to do further investigations, and the magnetic field is really limiting us, so we wanted to get rid of it. And so what we accomplished is, we have a laser beam now, which is like a laser pointer, and it traps the condensate. And there are, of course, some technical aspects. How can you expose a condensate to laser light and not heat it up? But I don't want to talk about that. I rather want to give you an outlook which creates big excitement in the field. Imagine you have a laser pointer. You shine this laser pointer in a vacuum chamber. And in the focus is a coherent matter wave, is this Bose condensate. Now we can take those condensates, move it close to surfaces, and learn how do coherent matter waves interact with surfaces. So we can really explore a variety of new physics because we are now able to move condensates around. A second aspect is, and some very nice work has been presented by the group in Boulder, is Bose condensate is sort of in between a gas and a liquid. And if you have one liquid, it's a very natural question to ask, how do different liquids mix? Do they mix? Do they phase separate? And you learn a lot of new physics by doing that. And this is now something which is catching up momentum. Unfortunately, I couldn't borrow transparencies from the Boulder group, so I have to show our own results. When we release atoms in the optical trap, we can see one condensate coming out, but we can also manipulate the condensate in that trap, and then we see that we have three condensates. And that's something which is even theoretically unexplored. What are three condensates doing? Are they mixing up? Are they repelling each other? And finally, there's a third advance, which just appeared a few weeks ago in Nature. It's the realization of a physicist's dream, namely tune your sample. I mean, imagine you are interested in electrical properties of solids, and you want to start a measurement series. You should at least look at an insulator, you should look at a semiconductor, and you should look at a metal. But if you ask a physicist to dream, he would say, I don't want to change my samples. I just want to tune a knob and get all the possible properties. And for the Bose condensate, we have found a knob now. For Bose condensate, the different properties are the strength of the interactions of the atoms. So we want atoms which attract each other, atoms which repel each other, and atoms which don't bother at all. They are like non-interacting atoms. And we have found, and actually there are things which are very interesting, if condensed atoms attract each other, the whole condensate might just implosively collapse, and it's very interesting to study the physics. People have actually predicted that the physics is the same physics as of a collapsing neutron star. So that's maybe one way to realize a neutron star in a small vacuum chamber. In any case, the knob which we which we have realized is used magnetic fields. I think I don't want to go through those three lines, what it really means, but the result is impressive. When we change the magnetic field, and read those numbers, it's 1,000 Gauss. We have to change the magnetic fields over hundreds of Gauss and nothing happens. But suddenly, we hit a resonance which involves molecular forces, and we see how the strength, the forces between atoms, dramatically change. So that has created excitement. We might now be able to design condensates, new forms of matter with new properties. So let me conclude with a short outlook, namely, what is this research good for? What can we do with both condensates and atom lasers? Now, I don't think that atom lasers are mostly harmless. I think they are completely harmless, because we can make coherent atoms only in very small quantities. We can only make femtomoles per hour. So if you would go to our lab and you want to harm somebody, the best thing is you just take the water cooling and hose the water against somebody. So atom lasers are minute quantities, and the other thing is atom lasers only propagate through the vacuum. So if you want to hit your enemy, you just ask him to stand still, wait a while, let me build a vacuum chamber between me and you, and then I will hit you. So that's the practical use, at least in that sense. But both condensation and the atom laser means that we have unprecedented control over the position and the motion of atoms. We are really at the limit where we are only restricted by Heisenberg's uncertainty relation. It's like single mode atoms. It's one quantum state. It's ultimate control. And now there are several areas in fundamental research, but also with some application where this might be exploited. I've already mentioned that we might be able to build better atomic clocks in the future by exploiting this control. There are also areas where we can just use that, maybe first for fundamental physics, to learn more about matter, to learn more about the forces, to learn more about the ultra-low temperature behavior, and actually also to learn much more about quantum mechanics. If you can see a wave function, you can really learn something about quantum mechanics and reveal some properties. But then there are some... Okay, I've mentioned that currently we can make coherent matter waves only in small quantities, femtomole per hour. Now, some people speculate what happens if you can make, you know, much more of that, if you can upgrade your production rate by a factor of a million. I admit we don't know how to do it. But let's assume we were able to do that. Maybe then you can use this unprecedented precision and deposit atoms on surfaces in very fine patterns, create new materials, or somehow contribute to nanotechnology. I don't want to speculate too much, and it's not clear whether this will be possible, but it's our job to find that out. And when I say our job, I mean myself and my collaborators at MIT and the other researchers in the field. And it's in the next couple of years, I think we will learn more about that. It's a young and developing field, and maybe we have answers in a few years. Thank you for your attention.
Can you give us an idea of the approximate size and velocity of a wave matter? Then we're talking about a millimeter and a foot an hour, a foot a year.
Okay. The question is, what is the physical relation of the sizes and the velocity? The condensates which you have seen were typically half a millimeter or a quarter millimeter in length. And those long cigars, they were maybe a factor of 10 smaller, so 20, 30 micrometer in width. Now, atoms in the condensate are still in some form of motion. I mean, they have to, because quantum mechanics always requires some zero-point motion. and the value of this motion has a scale which is millimeter per second. So this is sort of the last, I mean, in quantum mechanics nothing can stand still. You always have this sort of slow zero point motion, and the scale of that is sort of millimeter per second. So it's really slow, because ordinary atoms move at 1,000 meters per second. So that's the scale. Cold fusion. Actually, the situation is that what we observe, what we do here, is a very low energy phenomenon, and I assume for all conceivable ways of achieving fusion, you need some sort of activation energy. If you want to fuse nuclei, you have to overcome the electric repulsion. And this is often done in plasma machines by heating it up and creating, you know, a lot of thermal kinetic energy. And I'm not an expert in cold fusion, I don't want to become an expert in it, but in those speculations, things are overcome in some form of catalytic process. But here, we have just the atoms by themselves, so there's nothing which helps them to get together. So they would just be repellent. So it's definitely not a system which brings us anything closer to fusion.
Did you say you were using sodium atoms, and why did you choose sodium?
We are using sodium atoms mainly for technical reasons. There's only one big requirement in that whole game. You better pick a bosonic atom and not a fermionic one. But other than that, it's mainly the technological requirements of this experiment. We want to do laser cooling, so we pick an atom which has a resonance line in the visible or near infrared where we can use commercial lasers. Other atoms have transition lines in the far ultraviolet, and the laser technology is much harder. We also want to pick an atom which has an unpaired electron, because the unpaired electron means that the atom has a magnetic moment and can be magnetically trapped. So the choice of atom only reflects our cooling techniques. People have both condensed rubidium atoms and lithium atoms, and work is on its way in metastable helium, hydrogen, potassium. So these are good atoms for the techniques involved. That's a good question. How do we shake a condensate? I was alluding to that this trapped condensate is like a marble in a bowl. And you can shake the marble by shaking the bowl. Now, our bowl is magnetic fields. So we modulate the current in our coils that sort of displaces or modulates the bowl and therefore sets the condensate into motion. The typical number of atoms in those condensates is 100,000 to 10 million. So for atomic physics, that's a lot, because we have the ability to detect single atoms. But if you talk, or if you ask from the perspective of a chemist, if we produce 10 million condensed atoms twice a minute, that means we produce a femtomole per hour. And a femtomole, it's a millionth of a millionth of a thousandth of a mole. That's virtually nothing for a chemist. So that's why I was saying we are only able to produce small quantities for purposes like deposition of matter waves on surfaces. But for precision measurements, you can perform, actually, you can build a very accurate atomic clock just using a single atom. Sure. The way how the experiment starts is actually here. This is an atomic beam. So 1 meter away from that, everything is vacuum. 1 meter away, we have, in the end of our vacuum chamber, we have a piece of metallic sodium, and we heat it up. So we evaporate the sodium and create vapor of sodium. And it just streams down the machine and reaches that part where all the cooling takes place. So it's just evaporating sodium, creating gaseous sodium, and that just spreads through your machine and reaches that region. No sodium atoms, neutral sodium. It's a chunk of metal which is heated up above the melting point. It develops a vapor pressure, and this vapor just diffuses. And it diffuses to that part of the where the experiment takes place.
I guess you said earlier that your energy of your Bose-Einstein condensate is shaped by the container itself. Do you have higher order modes of the container? Or is it always the lowest order?
When the condensate is produced, the physics of Bose condensation is that the condensate forms in the lowest state. But when I showed you pictures of this sloshing condensate, so the condensate which undergoes oscillation, that can be regarded as a condensate in a higher mode. So we can excite higher modes and have condensates in higher modes. Actually, it's a good question. When we see something sloshing, then you see it is a superposition of two modes. So usually it's actually superpositions which we excite with these sloshing or shaking techniques. But it is conceivable to transfer the whole condensate to a higher mode. The rate of cooling is typically we spend 1 second on laser cooling, and then we spend 20 seconds on this evaporative cooling.
You can't trap until you've cooled, is that right?
That's a good point. I mean, the lasers, this first stage, the laser cooling, cools the atoms, and there's also some confinement of the laser beam. So what we really get is a 3-4 millimeter cloud of atoms, which are at a temperature of, let's say, a few hundred microkelvin and 3 or 4 millimeter in size. So this is a cloud which is laser cooled and optically trapped. And then comes the transfer where we use only magnetic forces to confine it, and then we let the atoms boil off or control the boil off, and this is the evaporation phase. That takes about 20 seconds. So it's really something which is hands-on. It's a stunning experience if everything works in the lab, which means two rooms full of machinery are perfectly aligned. Then you go to the computer, press a button, and half a minute later, you have one of those pictures of the condensate on the computer screen. And then you go around, you just tweak a few knobs, and then you see a condensate which shakes. It's really hands-on. You think you're really, you know, grabbing a wave function and manipulating it. It's very direct and visual.
What techniques are you using for measuring the temperature?
Oh, I'm glad that you asked this question. What is the technique for measuring the temperature? We have actually two techniques. One technique is... Oh, you've seen it. Let me just explain it with hands. One technique is we let the cloud expand. And there is a direct relationship between the velocity of a thermal gas and its temperature. So when we measure this expansion, I showed you this animation with this circular expansion, that's a direct measure of temperature. So actually, when you saw this cloud expanding with a few minutes of data analysis, we can tell you that this is 1 microkelvin temperature. The second technique is also very direct. When we observe cloud of atoms. When I use this analogy with the marble and the bowl, I told you that it takes energy to climb up the bowl or to go away from the center of the trapping potential. And this energy, how high the marble climbs the bowl, is also proportional to the temperature. So actually, a very easy way is we look not at the condensate, because this is a pure wave function, we look at this thermal cloud of atoms, we measure its length with a ruler, and this length is a measurement of the temperature. So this cloud here is about probably 1 or 2 microkelvin. It's really easy. The question was, is there a way to cool a condensate even further? Well, now you're really raising a very interesting question, namely the relation or the difference between energy and temperature. Temperature is always chaotic motion. Temperature is related to entropy, to that, you know, things are sort of going on in a chaotic way. So the thermal part of the cloud are always those atoms which move crisscross, if you remember this artist's picture. The condensate itself has no entropy. It is one state. So you cannot make a condensate colder. A pure condensate like this one is absolute zero temperature. But we can reduce its energy further because this condensate is a matter wave of 200 micrometer length. And if we make the box larger, the matter waves become longer and the energy, which is actually a zero point energy, becomes lower. So we can still make a condensate with less energy, but the temperature is already zero when we have a pure condensate. Actually, in current experiments, we try to make lower energy condensates because they might be nice for precision measurements and some things we have in mind.
How do you keep background radiation from your equipment from warming the atoms?
It doesn't matter. That's marvelous. I mean, the question is, how do we keep background radiation away from the atom? The wonderful thing is, we don't have to bother about it. There is background radiation. There are room temperature walls. But the situation is that atoms are very specific. They cannot absorb this radiation. And sodium atoms only absorb yellow light of a very specific frequency. And the overlap of where the atom can absorb with the spectrum of black body radiation is minuscule. So actually, we don't even have to switch off the lights. We can leave the lights on, shine room light on the condensate, it survives.
Well, let's thank Colonel Cunningham.